We made this.
Hello and welcome to Frame to Frame, part of the We Made This podcast network. We are the podcast that take two seemingly unconnected films and slam them together like a major riding a nuke. I'm Andy Williams.
And I'm Sean Wilson.
And this week we're talking to you about 114 in films. Yes, it's one of those extremely niche and kind of not really fair themes that we're doing.
But our speciality.
Well, yeah. We are the show that take two seemingly unconnected films and slam them together, so we'll do a plot. Yeah. And this is all based around Stanley Kubrick. So my favorite film director, he became kind of well known within his films for having 114 appearing in the films. And that started with our first film of this week, which is going to be Dr. Strangelove. And it has since been homaged in other films. And I think for the sake of everybody listening, we chose to do Welcome to Marwen because some of the other films were not great.
Well, you're making assumptions about Welcome to Marwen there in advance, but we'll get on to that. So
I mean, true. So it was the first time for us both watching Welcome to Marwen. So that's why we kind of chose that one as well. So we can't necessarily... Yeah. We could speak to the quality of the other films, which is why, you know,
yes,
we didn't choose
them. Yeah.
But yeah, we will be talking about both Dr. Strangelove or How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the Bomb and Welcome to Marwen. And that is the only time that the full title of Doctor Strange will be used in the entirety of this episode.
It's just, I mean, it's one of those titles where, you know, when you're editorializing something, you think, oh, for God's sake, like, I mean, every single time. And that is a real trend in movies lately. It's like, why not use one word when 10 will do? And it's just...
I mean, it's the way Charles Dickens wrote. So there we are.
It's true. Yeah.
And also, I really love the colon placement in the title, because it's Doctor Strangelove or, and then the rest of the title. And it must have been a real headache for people who were trying to keep the
because you'd automatically put it after Doctor Strangelove. That's obviously the actual place you put it. I mean, absolutely. What I mean, I'm trying to think what that suggests, actually. I mean, the idea that Doctor Strangelove as a name could be appended to, you know, because it's got the or in front of the colon. So, yeah, it's the Doctor Strangelove that leads the subtitle. So, obviously, yeah.
And the best part is we know that Stanley Kubrick would have had this discussion.
Oh, yeah.
It would have been absolutely at the heart of any... There would have been an actual conversation that he had with someone justifying why the colon was where it is.
Yeah, and they would have had, you know, 100 conversations about that. Quite grueling ones, probably.
Well, I mean, if we're talking grueling, we're going to get into Peter Sellers, but we'll come to that in a little bit. So let's start off, like we've already said, with Dr. Strangelove. So I'm going to put it out there right up front. I've already said that Kubrick's my favorite film director. I wrote my dissertation on Stanley Kubrick films, and I went back and read what I'd written about Dr. Strangelove, and I subsequently read it out to Sean because it was literally a paragraph and a half on Dr. Strangelove. Throughout the entire 10,000-word thing, there's literally a paragraph on Doctor Strangelove, which, you know, at least there's room for expansion, eh?
Aggressive expansion.
let's not get into that one.
Yeah.
So why don't we start off by talking about the plot of Doctor Strangelove? So it concerns the United States Air Force, who have launched an attack on Russia. This has happened because Brigadier General Jack D. Ripper has basically managed to find a way to supersede the ordinary chain of command by basically sidestepping President Merkin Muffley, which is a wonderful name, President Merkin Muffley's authority by using a loophole that has been put into place just in case that the commander-in-chief is not available. He has then managed to launch nuclear bombs. What this then leads to are bombers in the air that have had a directive to literally not be able to be spoken to by anybody. They can't be reached. CRM 114 has already kind of said, nope, no one is coming through like that. The only way to get through is through the use of a specific three-letter code. So what we have are a few different threads. Number one, Captain Mandrake trying to sort of find out what the code is. Number two, you've got a load of politicians and bureaucrats sat within the war room. And then number three, you've got Major King Kong in the aeroplanes with his team actually delivering the payloads to Russia. So Kubrick sets it up as a farcical comedy, and it's always a strange notion to have a comedy set around war, right? That's this is literally the most horrific thing you can experience. So, you know, we're on a strange plane here with Stanley Kubrick and comedy, bearing in mind this is a Stanley Kubrick that's done Spartacus, that's done Paths of Glory, that's done Lolita, but he's yet to do what would be considered his masterpieces. Like, if you're talking great runs of Kubrick films, you're kind of talking from Doctor Strangelove forwards. I know you would argue Eyes Wide Shut, but we're not getting into that now. We already did that.
That was almost a line from Airplane. That so we're not getting into that right now.
So, I'm not having that argument with you again. So, you know, Doctor Strangelove is, when you think in the Kubrick oeuvre, there are an awful lot of sort of dry comic lines, but there are no other real out and out comedies in the way that Doctor Strangelove is. And what is very, very strange is that when you've got a film that speaks so much to the time in which it was made, very often it doesn't age very well because it has to be watched within that specific time. Like, we had this with Secret Honor on the episode we had with Tony a couple of weeks ago. If you'd have watched it at the time, it would have made far more of an impact, whereas watching it now, it kind of doesn't connect. Doctor Strangelove has absolutely none of that. I think that it is an absolute masterpiece, and Peter Sellers is literally never been better, coming from someone who has not seen any of the Pink Panther movies. So, Sean, why don't you tell me what you think about Doctor Strangelove?
Well, before I do, I'd completely forgotten about that fact. So I'm just having to process that again. I mean, you've not watched the Pink Panther, not even on a lazy bank holiday when you were younger, when the Pink Panther movies always turned up on terrestrial. You didn't see them. Not one.
I always wanted to watch A Shot in the Dark. I've heard that one's quite good.
But well, yeah, actually, ironically, I think that's the one that I probably watched the least, despite being the best one. But back to Doctor Strangelove. Yeah, I mean, it's a masterpiece. I mean, my favourite Stanley Kubrick movie, I think, is still Paths of Glory, the World War One drama, which I just think is absolutely astonishing. But Doctor Strangelove is, you know, set the benchmark for like black comedies. And I think what works about it is that, as with all the best black comedies, it's only a hop, skip and a jump away from horror and actually being able to be taken seriously. And I think this is entirely a credit to the very, very static, dispassionate form of the direction. You know, the direction doesn't attempt to make the subject matter funny. It doesn't try to jazz up what's going on. The direction has got a very kind of sort of detached style. And I think what the film does, it invites the audience to subjectively find the humour in the movie. But what's actually depicted, you know, particularly in light of what's happened in the political climate over the last 5 to 10 years, no longer appears all that farcical. I mean, it's interesting that Kubrick initially was going to fashion this as a serious movie, and then he thought, no, it's all so futile, this is going to have to be reworked as a black comedy, which I think kind of says everything that you need to know about the principles behind it. And I find that really fascinating.
You referenced Airplane, that is also a film that is almost played very, very straight by everyone in. Like, the joke of Airplane is that they're not in on the joke.
Yeah.
That's kind of their thing. And it's similar with Doctor Strangelove, in that when they say these outlandish things, when you've got George C. Scott sort of playing quite big as a character, he plays General Buck Turgeson, and he is sort of very big as a character, to the extent that, you know, George C. Scott actually was kind of tricked by Kubrick, in that Kubrick got him to do the takes that he said, you know what, do it bigger. I promise you I won't use these takes. These are just for rehearsal.
And he ended up using them.
And they were the ones. So for years, George C. Scott was like, he hated, he said he'd never wanted to work with Kubrick again. But it subsequently come back like this is his favorite performance of his. So, you know, the world.
All worked out in the end, yeah.
Absolutely. So, but the point is, like, these people are not in on the joke. What is funny about the film is the farcical situations that they end up in, and frankly, some of the dialogue, like, gentlemen, you can't fight in here, this is the war room, is kind of the oft-quoted line. And that kind of speaks to the film. It's so biting that on first watch or first listen to even to the dialogue, you might not necessarily get that as a joke, but it's only when you think about it and go, the war,
that sounds absurd. Yeah, I mean, that it's a testament to the movie that, you know, the acting can be read in one of two ways. For everything that somebody watching it finds blackly funny, somebody else could be watching it thinking, hang on a minute, no, I don't find that funny at all. I actually find that quite scary. And that's the essence of like great black comedy. And I think that with the exception of Doctor Strangelove himself, none of the characters are necessarily played comedically. They're all played very, and that's entirely to this, to the tremendous success of Peter Sellers, Kubrick, and the rest of the cast and the crew. And I think that, you know, the reason why we see the characters as funny is because we bring our subjective experience to the movie. I mean, you can't say that Gentlemen, You Can't Fight in Here, This is the War Room is any more ludicrous than some of the political rhetoric that's come out on both sides of the Atlantic in the last 5 or 10 years. I mean, you know, that line, you know, it's kind of, that line could be taken seriously in a drama now. You know, that could just be presented very, very matter of factly, and it could not be funny. It could just be presented completely straight faced. And I think it's really fascinating the way that Kubrick allows the humor to come out from an audience's perspective, and he doesn't invite Peter Sellers to mug in his three roles. Originally it was going to be four roles. Yeah. And, you know, Peter Sellers was going to play Slim Pickens' character, and then he faked having a broken ankle because he didn't want to do it, so he backed out of it.
It was a condition from the studio to make the film in the first place, was basically because much of the success of Lolita, which I'll be talking about with Bo Nicholson on Movieversaries at some point between now and the end of the year. I'm still waiting for an actual date from him. But I'll be talking about Lolita. Much of the success of it comes from Peter Sellers' performance and the fact that his character, Humbert, like, takes on a number of different identities. And Kubrick accepted the fact that, Sellers will play multiple roles, and then the studio dictated that they wanted him to play four. And then they managed to whittle it down. So he plays Captain Mandrake, he plays President Muffley, and he plays Dr. Strangelove. And he was absolutely brilliant in every single one of those roles. He's so, so good. There's very few actors that Kubrick has worked with more than once. And there's even fewer actors that Stanley Kubrick let improvise. And Peter Sellers was one of them on Lolita and in Dr. Strangelove.
Well, yeah, because Kubrick basically said that, you know, he wanted actors, he wanted to basically break down an actor's defences and help them find new things through repeated takes. And Kubrick often spoke disparagingly of actors, saying, well, the more you get an actor to do that, very often the more they go off the boil. But the more he got Peter Sellers to do it, the more Peter Sellers found more nuances and more registers in each character. And Kubrick was absolutely stunned by this. I think he found a soulmate in Peter Sellers, and Peter Sellers also made Kubrick laugh. Apparently it was a very, very difficult thing to do. And you can see how beautifully Peter Sellers inhabits these roles. It's not just that, oh, as Mandrake, he's got a mustache, as Merkin Muffley, he's got you know, the balding pate, as Dr. Strange, he's got the, you know, the black glove and the nut, then, you know, the impromptu Nazi salute. It's not just the physical gimmicks. Like, when you look at Peter Sellers as each of those characters, you're not looking at Peter Sellers, you are looking at the characters. And they are so clearly delineated. I mean, Peter Sellers famously said that outside of his characters, he had no personality of his own. And he's not the first comic to have said that. I think it runs in the industry. But he gave himself over so much to his portrayals. And it's at its absolute apex in this. And I think that, I mean, it's hard to distinguish which of the characters are my favorite. Actually, watching it again, I really like the character of Mandrake. Because I think
Mandrake.
Yeah. There's a tragicomic quality to it.
Yeah, and he's very, like, you can see the influence on, like, Hugh Laurie in Blackadder, for example, from Captain Mandrake. The first time I watched the film, I wasn't particularly aware of Peter Sellers. I didn't really know what was going on. I didn't actually realize that it was the same actor played three separate roles.
That's how good he was. You didn't even know. Yeah, that's how brilliant it is.
It was only sort of then, you know, you watch it a few times, because this was when I was properly falling in love with Kubrick, and this was a later one that I fell in love with anyway. But yeah, I didn't actually realize that it was three separate actors. And, you know, he suffered a heart attack not long after this film. And, you know, he puts it down to the workload that he had on Dr. Strangelove, basically carrying these three performances, because, yeah, when you've got the three different stories that I mentioned earlier, like one in with Mandrake trying to get the code out of Jack D. Ripper, one in the war room, which is where Muffley and Dr. Strangelove are, and the one in the airplane with King Kong. He anchors two of them, and he anchors the two of the three storylines so amazingly well. Interestingly, he because he improvised and he wasn't one to do it again and again and again and again. Like, he'd do it a few times, but he wasn't necessarily one to constantly redo what he's just done. The final scene where he stands up as Dr. Strangelove and says, "My Fuhrer, I can walk." That was like, he did that once, but it was shot like Kubrick had set up six different cameras. So he had full coverage of the final scene because he knew that Sellers wouldn't want to do it more than once. Have you seen the original ending?
No, I don't believe I have.
Okay. So for those that are unaware, there was an original cream pie fight at the ending of the final cut of the original cut of the film. It was taken out because Kubrick just decided it was not consistent with the satirizing of the rest of the film. It was more broad, so he took it out. That also kind of had a bit of a controversial moment in it, in that it was test screened on November the 22nd, 1963, which is a very infamous date in history because that was the assassination of John F. Kennedy.
Eek.
And there was a moment in the first test screening where Muffley takes a pie to the face and Turgidson says, "Gentlemen, our gallant young president has been struck down in his prime." Obviously, that was done.
Yeah.
It was taken out anyway because the whole scene was taken out. But yeah, the fact they had the test screening on the actual day of, it was like, didn't.
It just goes to show, doesn't it, how, you know, these great tides of history can sometimes line up, you know, majestically, unexpectedly with art, you know, with any form of art, irrespective of whether it's the ending that they chose. I do love the portrayal of Merkin Muffley again, you know, in contrast to the kind of stiff upper lip of Mandrake and, you know, the raving kind of neo-Nazi stylings of Strangelove. You know, Muffley just, it's the stillness and the bureaucracy of the character. I mean, the sequence where you're first introduced to the war room, and we've got to say another MVP on this movie, Ken Adam, one of the best production designers of all time. The extraordinary set that he did for the war room. Ken Adam famously worked on the Bond films.
So I saw a miniature of at the Kubrick exhibition. They'd done it was the miniature that they'd used as a concept prior to the filming. They actually had that at the Kubrick exhibition at the Design Museum when it was there. And it was phenomenal. Like, that was, I didn't take many pictures around there because I was trying to kind of take it all in. But that kind of Fritz Lang Metropolis-esque look to the war room is just, it's absolutely stunning.
I mean, what I love about the first bit of proper dialogue we get between President Merkin Muffley and Buck Turgidson, George C. Scott's character, is, you know, you've got a kind of shot, reverse shot, but occasionally the camera cuts away to basically almost lose them within the wider circle of everyone sitting there, and you have to actually pick them out and and I think it's making a point about, ultimately, everyone is indistinguishable. It's all a farce. It's all a bit of a nihilistic mess, you know, the fact that these two characters can kind of get lost amidst the extreme long shot, but there are
most important characters.
Yeah, exactly. But that's the point, isn't it? They're both most important and least important at the same moment, which is one of the points that Kubrick is making, which is that, well, what does it all matter in the end? But just, you know, the way that Muffley is attempting to kind of break through the kind of Orwellian doublethink of what Turgidson is saying. It's kind of, hang on, I'm the only person with nuclear sign-off. Yeah, but have you heard of Code R? So you signed off on that. And then Muffley just has got this sort of stoic impasse on his face. It's kind of, you know, and, you know, the classic, well, you know.
Worryingly, this was actually possible. It was, so Kubrick did, as Kubrick did for everything, he did a copious amount of research on nuclear war, on nuclear theory, and he basically found that this thing was actually possible, was that there was something in place that if the commander-in-chief couldn't be reached, that there was a way that it could have been exploited. And it had been changed prior to the film's release, which is then how the US government could have said, oh yeah, this is so unbelievable, it could never happen, rah, rah, rah. But it not that it could never happen, it could never happen now. It could have happened, but we're not going to tell you that.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's they kind of throw away a reference to the missile gap, which is, you know, the theory that one nation has far more nuclear warheads than another. Like, they kind of throw a reference into that towards the end when they're talking about, like, squirreling away in bunkers. And, you know, Strangelove comes up with this this kind of abhorrent theory of a 10-to-1 male to female ratio for the breeding program to repopulate the Earth. It's not ideal, is it?
And then he pulls out the little, he looks inside his jacket for the little disc indicating the half-life. And of course the Nazi hand has already kind of got it, and he's kind of like looks at it and sort of, I'll have that. Was a half-life, as I would say, 100 years, like that. And then he puts it back in. But I mean, just, yeah, the fact that it is just, it can be read in one or two ways. It's either a hop, skip, and a jump away from reality, in as much as you see it as absurdism, or it is reality. And I think the movie can be read in both ways. And I think that is the beauty of it. It's the beauty of the way it's directed. The relative straight-facedness of the performances. I know George C. Scott was angry that his jumped up apparently kind of rehearsal takes were used, but I mean you look at George C. Scott's portrayal of Buck Turgeson now, that character doesn't seem over the top compared to a lot of what we've had in the real world. Yeah. You know, naming names over the last few years. I mean, that character seemed relatively sober and relatively quiet, which says a lot. So,
well. One of the things that he said was that perhaps, Mr. President, it might be better if you concerned yourself with the American people than your image in the history books, which is one of the most biting lines.
Yeah.
And it's still a biting line. It's brilliant. But, I mean, Kubrick managed to calm down George C. Scott in between takes by George C. Scott, a very, very accomplished chess player, never beat Kubrick.
So didn't he play chess with Malcolm McDowell on the set of Clockwork Oranges as well? Yeah, he
was famous for doing so. Yeah,
I just love the it's terrific. I mean, we've got to mention the whole the Dimitri sequence, where I think Kubrick is actually very generous in terms of the way he frames his shots and the way he cuts between not just Peter Sellers but the rest of the ensemble as well. We were always talking about the bomb, Dimitri, the bomb, the hydrogen bomb. And it's like, and you get his end of the conversation. You know exactly what Dimitri is saying on the other end. Well, how do you think I feel about it, Dimitri? And then you've got George C. Scott, Buck Turgeson, is trying to cover up the fact that he's chewing gum and he's kind of like looking at him. But I think you've also got to credit Peter Bull as the Soviet ambassador, Alexei, who's basically being invited in. And while Murky Muffley is having that conversation, that increasingly one-sided conversation, Alexei is kind of just, he's kind of looking at Muffley with this kind of sort of unblinking, like sort of incredulous kind of stare. And the way Kubrick deliberately frames him like that, but the direction doesn't call attention to the fact that he's framing him. We just pick out the fact that he's looking at the American president, trying to verbally extricate himself from the situation. Like, right, yeah, we've announced war in your country, but don't take it badly, Dimitri.
it's like
I'm just as sorry as you are, Dimitri. I'm capable of just being as sorry as you are. And it's like the way Kubrick picks out other people's reactions to what's going on in a very, very quiet, very detached manner. I think it's very funny. It still stands up now.
Absolutely. I completely agree with you. We very, very often talk about a film score. And we've also spoken, I think, more off mic than on about Kubrick's lack of love, shall we say, for an original score. There was music in Dr. Strangelove by Laurie Johnson. What do you make of it?
Well, there isn't that much original score in it. I mean, the main theme is When Johnny Comes Marching Home, which is the piece that's aligned with the bomber crew. And, you know, again, that's much for, it's for ironic deflection, because it gives you that patriotic gung-ho spirit in the face of imminent nuclear catastrophe. So that's obviously what Kubrick did. And obviously the end credits montage of nuclear war is set to Vera Lynn, you know, where we will meet again. So that's something that Kubrick did very, very famously with Needle Drops.
It's maddening that when you think of how iconic We'll Meet Again is and how associated it is with Britishness and the Second World War, that this New Yorker, this Jewish New Yorker, was able to come across and really capture like that British spirit.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think Kubrick was effectively an adopted Brit. I'd say he was probably, even though he was born in America, he was more British than American, because obviously he lived over here. I think he had a very British sensibility. He had a very British sense of irony and darkness, which is what allowed him to make this. And that's what allowed him to interpret a song like that in such a brilliant way. I mean, When Johnny Comes Marching Home always makes me think of, funnily enough,
Die
with a Vengeance, because Michael Caine, you know, your brother was an asshole. He was an arsehole. You got his number.
I'm so glad that we agreed on the reference point.
Yeah, no, and I mean, you know, Simon Gruber, Jeremy Irons' character, doesn't sound too unlike Dr. Strangelove in some ways.
That is true.
Not a lot of original score music in it. I mean, it does divert me on to say that, you know, the scenes in the bomber are part of the reason why the film works so well, because those scenes are taken very seriously. You know, they're really concerned with the minutiae of the survival kit. Lipstick, condom, stockings. Oh, God, can have a good night out in Vegas with all this stuff. It's just Slim Pickens.
Well, that's it. Slim Pickens didn't know he was making a comedy.
And doesn't that make my point? Doesn't that make my point that this film can be read in two ways simultaneously?
We mentioned that Sellers was supposed to be playing that character.
Yeah.
But then and Slim Pickens came on set sort of raspy accent, and he was wearing cowboy hat and all this sort of stuff. And they went, he's here to play a part, right? He's not Marlon Brando-ing this stuff. But he was exactly who they needed him to be. And, you know, the whole yeehaw at the end, riding on top of the nuclear bomb, that was referenced in famously Armageddon with Steve Buscemi doing the same thing on the moon, because, you know, it's easier to take drillers to a moon than it is to train astronauts to drill.
What's the betting that Michael Bay, the director, thought he'd come up with an original image there and someone went, Michael, it's already been done before. I bet that happened.
I'm loath to do this, but I'm going to give Bay the credit of thinking.
Okay.
I know. Trust me, no one is more surprised than me that when we're talking about Stanley Kubrick, I'm talking about giving Michael Bay credit. That's upsetting.
Yeah.
So I'm going to stop doing that and go back to, I mean, so for me, this, I mean, it's definitely top 10 Kubrick, right? It's
oh yeah,
fantastic.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Considering, you know, he only made like 12 movies. So it's definitely top 10.
It's a masterpiece. I mean, it's just, again,
so are the rest of the films. That's the point I'm making.
Well, not all of them. I mean, I would say the first half of Full Metal Jacket is masterful. I'm not so keen on the second half of it. I mean, we know what I think about Eyes Wide Shut.
We can go back and listen to the Full Metal Jacket episode as well, if anybody's interested.
Yeah, we'll find that. I mean, it's the nature of the framing. I mean, something about, you know, the most famous line in the movie, gentlemen, you can't fight in here, this is the war room. I mean, there's something about just the way that's set up, like the way that George C. Scott and Peter Bull are kind of fighting, they fall back onto the bench, then Peter Sellers enters the frame from the right in kind of profile. So it's something about the fact we don't actually get to see him full on while he says that line. He just sort of comes in casually from the side and just sort of belts it out. There's the blocking and the staging of the humor is very discreet and very deadpan and very funny and very minimalist. That's why it works. You know, Kubrick doesn't impose himself on the comedy. And I think that's why you can take it seriously, or you can take it as a very, very absurdist, quite terrifying farce in which you're kind of left to think, wow, did the world actually get annihilated at the end? Or is that kind of a metaphorical montage at the end? You know, what do you think it all ends with us all dying?
That's exactly what I think Kubrick's going for. Kubrick is such a nihilist that I thought that was the point, was that there we go. It's all gone to hell. What influence do you think this has had on somebody like Armando Iannucci, do you think?
It's actually scary how much you crawl inside my head and anticipate that. I mean, absolutely. I mean, you know, The Thick of It and In the Loop very much walk that razor's edge between humour and horror, between, you know, the festering horror that lurks at the heart of government spin and the fact that it's so appalling and so evil and so noxious and so toxic that you can't help but laugh at it. Because you can't quite believe that as a species, we've got ourselves into this kind of situation. And there is something to be said when something is so appalling, you can't help but laughing at it. And I think that's what Kubrick does in Dr. Strangelove. You know, this is such a kind of overwhelming, cataclysmic situation that what can you do but laugh? You know, we are all insignificant cockroaches in the face of it. You know, whether you're Mandrake, whether you're Muffley, whether you're, you know, Dr. Strangelove, who, you know, obviously the way Sellers plays Strangelove is that he's got obviously got a certain degree of relish in terms of he's obviously got divided loyalties. The fact that, you know, his one of his arms is still Nazi, even if the rest of his body is actually a repatriated American citizen. So, you know, it's great.
Yeah.
It's terrific.
And this coming out on this of all weeks, shall we say.
Yeah.
So we will end the Doctor Strangelove chat with that. Just suffice to say, I think we both think it is utterly brilliant, and it's pound for pound Kubrick's funniest movie. That's without saying. But I think what often gets overlooked is what you mentioned, is how well he manages to direct it, because a lot of the other Kubrick films, that especially the later Kubrick films, you look at and like, they're so beautifully shot and they're so deliberately shot, and in a way that you sit and you marvel at it. Whereas I think in Doctor Strangelove, you look at it and you admire it, but it's more about what's being said and how the characters are interacting, less so than it is about, look how beautiful this shot is. So Doctor Strangelove, heartily recommended. On that note, we're going to heartily recommend another We Made This podcast. So if you listen to this, and when you come back, we will be discussing Welcome to Marwan.
Do you like crime stories, books, and people talking about those things? Then you should check out the Red and Buried podcast.
A murder.
Oh!
I'm Frankie.
And I'm Sarah.
And in each episode, we pick a different theme and surprise and delight each other with a cheeky little review.
As you started reading, I was like, this sounds like a romance novel. And then you got to monstrous crime.
Yay, there it is. That's what we're here for, isn't it?
We're also regularly visited by many talented and best-selling authors, including the likes of Chris Whittaker, Elizabeth Haynes, Emma Stonex, Fiona Cummins, and a whole lot more.
I obviously listened to the podcast, and I listened to you interviewing Chris Whittaker, and I thought, oh, hey, that sounds like a really good fun podcast.
If you like your crime books with a big side of silly, this is the podcast for you. Listen to the Red and Buried podcast right now, brought to you by the We Made This Network.
So Welcome to Marwan is a 2018 American drama directed by the director of Back to the Future, Robert Zemeckis. We could have done, as part of our 114 in films, we could have done Back to the Future, but we've already done that one. So we kind of had to sidestep that. It's something that Zemeckis has quoted on a number of occasions, but we chose Welcome to Marwan. So Sean, why don't you tell us a little bit about the plot?
So, dramatization of the real life events that featured in the 2010 documentary Marwan Cole, which was directed by Jeff Malmberg. So what you effectively get in this is the tragic true story of Mark Hogenkamp, played by Steve Carell, who is a man who suffered a hate crime outside a bar, was viciously beaten. As he said, they kicked the memories out of him. And he, prior to the attack, he was an artist. After the attack, he no longer had the ability to draw or to write. So he basically, in this reclusive existence, he refashioned himself as a model maker and as a photographer. And what Mark has effectively done at the outset of the movie is he has invented this miniature model village of Marwan, a Belgian town, and he has populated it with dolls, which are effectively allegorical stand-ins for his personality and the tragedies in his life and the people whom he admires as well. So the doll, primarily represented by Hoagie, which is the army stand-in for Mark himself, and then variously the women of Marwan, the very strong women of Marwan, which mirror the women in Mark's own life. The newest addition to which is Nicole, who mirrors Mark's new neighbour, also called Nicole, played by Leslie Mann. She just moved in across the street. So what you effectively have is a Robert Zemeckis movie that jumps between live action tragedy and CGI animation, in which the world of Marwan, the world of the dolls, is actually brought to life in sort of allegorical, satirical, absurdist Terry Gilliam style effect. And the movie jumps between the two of them in a bid to understand what happens to this guy. And it's horrific, really horrific. It also underscored with an air of redemption. So a strong cast. I mentioned Steve Carell and Leslie Mann. You've also got Diane Kruger in there, who is the kind of demonic presence kind of floating over Marwan. And one suspects that the doll that she's voicing is kind of represents Mark's inner demons. You've also got Janelle Monáe, Isaac Gonzalez.
I think it's key that Diane Kruger's character never actually appears in the real world. Exists in Marwan. So, you know, exactly. It's kind of saying exactly what you said. It's she exists specifically in that.
Yeah, it's more illusory. Yeah, you know, like you said, if they don't have a real life surrogate, then yeah, it's more illusory and more metaphorical than the other characters. But Isaac Gonzalez, Gwendolyn Christie, Leslie Zemeckis as well. And I mean, it's interesting because Robert Zemeckis has very often used fantasy as sort of a metaphorical exploration of what's going on in real life. I mean, the best example of that would probably be for me, Who Framed Roger Rabbit, which is one of my favorite childhood films, and which I can't believe we haven't covered that yet. Because
I tried to watch the personal stuff. I tried to watch that with the kids today. Mm. They would not interested, and I gave them the choice of Who Framed Roger Rabbit and Turner and Hooch, and they chose Turner and Hooch, of which we watched half.
Okay. Did Turner and Hooch go down well? It's not a bad choice.
Well, we didn't finish it, so...
What, did you not finish it because they didn't enjoy it, or just because you were distracted?
They were distracted.
Oh, okay, fine. I mean, I would say...
I absolutely agree with you on Roger Rabbit.
Oh, it's a masterpiece. I mean, it's so brilliant. And the way it uses the mixture of live action and cartoon characters to interrogate xenophobia, racism, you know, paranoia, 1950s corruption. I mean, Who Framed Roger Rabbit is effectively a riff on Chinatown. And, you know, all that obviously goes completely over your head when you're younger, but you grow into that richness when you get older. And it's an extraordinary film. And what, you know, Zemeckis performs a similar kind of principle here, albeit less successfully, which is that, you know, Mark escapes the world via the real world, the harsh reality of the real world via his dolls. You know, the world of the dolls are what makes sense to him. And, you know, the people around him variously humor him, mock him, sneer at him. At one point, you know, he goes to the court trial of the people who assaulted him, and he's told by his lawyers, can you not bring the dolls in? And he says, no, I need to bring one of them in with me. And he brings Hoagie in with him into the courtroom. So, you know, it is that kind of Who Framed Roger Rabbit thing of like fantasy can be used to interrogate reality. And it's not a new concept. I mean, fairy tales have done that since time immemorial. I have to say, I haven't seen the documentary Marwan Cole, so I can't juxtapose it against that. Have you seen Marwan Cole?
I have not. I was aiming to ahead of this podcast. I just didn't have time in which to
I couldn't find it. I couldn't find it anywhere. I wanted to as well, but I couldn't find it anywhere. So
that is annoying. So I didn't actually know. So right at the start, I knew nothing about what it was about. I remembered it being a flop, and we'll come to its performance a bit later on. But I remembered it being a flop, and I just never caught up with it. So when I sat down to watch it, I was like, well, hang on, is this whole film going to be this kind of like Polar Express, Philippe Petit kind of dead eye looking CGI? Because at the point in the start of the film, you're with Hoagie and
you start with the dolls. Yeah.
And
yeah.
It really set me off on the wrong foot. And I was like, hang on a minute. It's like, if this is going to be like this the whole time, then it's really going to annoy me because the CGI is not very good. Like he looks fake. He looks plastic, I guess, in retrospect. And then it was only when I learned that it was in the world of the dolls as the story progresses, you go, oh, right, okay, fine. That makes sense now.
So it's actually quite a clever way to begin it because it's genuinely discombobulating, and you kind of, you understand Mark's allegorical journey before you understand his real one, which is kind of a smart thing to do. It's a good way to begin it, I think.
But it was the kind of dead eyes you saw in Joseph Gordon-Levitt when he was playing Philippe Petit in Zimwalk. And you know, the trilogy of Polar Express, Beowulf and Christmas Carol. It was that kind of like that didn't quite sit right.
Beowulf, when I'm gonna kill your monster. It's like, blimey. Did Beowulf hang around Peckham, did he? It's hilarious.
Yeah. Wow. You're just gonna have a go at other films now, so that's fine. But I think on the whole, it worked for me. It worked. It pulled me in. I think that Steve Carell played a particularly good character. I think, like, obviously I can't speak to the real Mark Hogan camp, but what Steve Carell brought to this role is something that we said literally last week on this podcast, in that he brings a level of heart and he brings an expectation that you don't expect to it. Whereas, you know, when we were talking about John DuPont last week, it's a very, very different performance. Steve Carell is a warm character. He's a warm actor. For the most part, and that's what made John DuPont such a great performance. But to bring in a level of warmth, but also to kind of portray, you know, that it's a level of PTSD, I guess, in what Hogan Camp has, I thought he did extremely well. The one thing that didn't sit well with me was how wildly the tone shifts in the fun, fantastical elements of of Marwan and Marwan Cole later on, to the real world where, you know, this hate crime has happened and he's suffering such sort of distress and ill effect as a result of it. And I mean, it kind of goes from one to the other very, very quickly and very, very jarringly. Did you find that at all?
Yeah, well, the ironic thing was I thought the film was on surer footing when it was depicting the fantastical elements more so than when it was doing the live action elements. So I thought Zemeckis found more surrealism and dramatic impetus in the sequence with the dolls, and I thought the live action stuff felt like a bit limp and a bit kind of like, well, you know, in the live action sections, we're already tracking over stuff that presumably is being covered in the documentary, and the documentary is obviously objective. That's the needs of a documentary. And it was almost like they when they were making the dramatization, this film, it's kind of like, right, what can we do that the documentary didn't do? What we can do is use CGI, which Robert Zemeckis is very famous for, and go inside the world of the dolls. You think, okay, fine. But once you're outside that world, you're not doing anything new that the documentary didn't already trace. And not only that, I got the sense that it was actually going a bit soft. I don't really think that it threatens to engage with the darker aspects of Mark's personality, and I think it backs off the development with the Leslie Mann character, which doesn't end up going the way he thinks it goes. I think it goes a little bit kind of maudlin, and I think they should have gone more with that. Again, I get the impression that a man who had gone through a horrific experience like this, you know, his ensuing existence would be much more prickly and unpredictable, and I think the film kind of flattens it out into the usual kind of maudlin Hollywood redemptive arc. I'm like, I don't think real life kind of fits those kind of boxes, but you know, this is a Hollywood drama, so it is adherent to those kind of principles in a way that the documentary wouldn't necessarily be.
I mean, it's difficult to discuss when we haven't seen the documentary, right?
Yeah, but I mean, you know, I mean, everything involves a degree of editorialization. All documentaries are editorialized, and I imagine Marwan Cole is the same. And this, the Welcome to Marwan, is definitely editorialized, in as much as there is an arc. There is the serio-tragic, ultimately redemptive arc, which Hollywood is so enamored with, and which Robert Zemeckis has done before. I mean, you look at something like Forrest Gump, which again used fantasy colliding with reality, inserting Tom Hanks into historical events, you know, inserting Forrest Gump into historical events. This is something that Robert Zemeckis does very well.
Having a dog thrust upon him that he didn't necessarily... Oh, wait, no, I'm getting confused again, aren't I?
Yeah, exactly.
No, I agree with you. Robert Zemeckis does that balancing act very, very well. Literally, which is why he directed The Walk, I guess. The reason for the theme this week is that when Mark is in the store and he's buying a Purple Heart, the label next to it references CRM-114, which was the machine in Doctor Strangelove that you know, it's a callback to Kubrick. There were a number of Back to the Future callbacks in the film, including to Alan Silvestri's score. So he is the often collaborator of Robert Zemeckis. What did you make of his work this time around?
Yeah, he and Robert Zemeckis have got a legendary collaboration going right the way back to Romancing the Stone. It's one of the most famous and important director-composer collaborations in film history, and still going really strong now. Yeah, I really liked it. I mean, it's interesting that the doll sequences, with all the World War II kind of action and espionage done with all these figures, it's presented in a heightened action, bombastic fashion. And because you start with that, Alan Silvestri's score hits you with that classic Alan Silvestri militaristic style, Predator, Back to the Future style music. Mm-hmm. And so the music plugs you in straight away to the idea that the world of the dolls is operating on a kind of more heightened level of emotion as per what's going on in Mark's head as he's actually photographing them in real life. But then what you get is that's offset with the more intimate, understated harmonics of Mark in the real world, which uses like clarinet and flutes. But then what you do get is the musical world of the dolls starts to then infect the militaristic snare drum, starts to infect the world of the real world. And then the music sort of informs us how fantasy and reality are all crossing over to mirror the confusion of this character, the PTSD afflicted confusion of this character. I mean, I imagine a lot of people would probably say rather sneeringly, well, the music tells us too much. But I mean, Zemeckis and Silvestri come out of an era where music in movies did tell you what was going on. And, you know, when music wasn't afraid to do that, I think people have become much more sneering and cynical about that. And
so what's this? You're talking in the 80s now when it was... Because, I mean, yeah, it's calling back to your Steiners, isn't it? It's calling back to that action scoring.
It's calling back to an unselfconscious mode of film scoring. And I think audiences have become much more snarky about that. And I think Silvestri and Zemeckis always play on the front foot with their music in terms of kind of manipulating your emotions. That's what film music is meant to do. It's an act of manipulation. You shouldn't hide it. And certainly I can see why people might see the score for this movie, Welcome to My Island, being syrupy. I didn't think it was syrupy. I thought it was very sincere. I thought it was very well spotted, very well located in the edit, as all of Zemeckis and Silvestri's collaborations are. That's another reason why the film feels slightly old-fashioned, the fact that, you know, it is a movie that wears its heart on its sleeve, including with its music. And I can see why that might have made people slightly uncomfortable and slightly queasy, and probably one of the reasons why it didn't do very well. Financially, it didn't do well at all.
No, it was a massive, massive flop for Universal. Bearing in mind, this came out, what, a week after Mortal Engines had also flopped for Universal as well. It was predicted at the time to lose between 50 and 60 million for Universal. You know, it didn't do that badly, but it didn't do well either. So his budget was reportedly between $39 and $50 million, and it took $13.1 million at the box office. It was drubbed by critics, kind of saying what we've said, but I think we, on the whole, I'm not going to speak for you, but I'm going to ask the question. I think we're a bit more positive, aren't we, than a lot of the critics were.
I think it's a very, very, very flawed movie. Not all of it works, but I think its heart is in the right place. I think it's got good intentions and decent performances. And I think in its best moments, it does use surrealistic fantasy to kind of elucidate what's going on in the main character's head, because obviously a film can't do that. A film can't visually articulate. It can find a substitute for it. And I think this film does do that. I think it walks the razor's edge between being sincere and being patronizing, and I can completely understand why some people would see the doll sequences as a very, very clumsy, patronizing way of basically articulating PTSD.
They were my favorite part of the
film.
Yeah,
same.
That was the part of the film that flew for me, was the doll sequences. I think that the real world was
a bit limp.
When we were in the real world, I wanted to be back in the doll world. I wanted to be back in Marwan. And I don't understand necessarily why it got the hate that it did, and why it was I can understand why it was financially unsuccessful, because like you and I, who were relatively warm on the film, didn't go and see it when it came out.
I think it's very telling that Universal released it, you know, in that Christmas graveyard slot. They obviously didn't have any faith in it, and they just wanted to get rid of it. You're always very political with these studios in terms of when they release their movies. So
well, quite, and we're recording this at the end of August, so you know, let's just say no more.
Yeah, exactly.
So that will pretty much do us for this week's episode of Frame to Frame. We're going to be taking a 2-week break because one of us is very selfish and going on holiday. So I'll let you decide which one that is. When we return, we will be discussing suing big entities. So we're going to be discussing the little man suing the big man, I guess. David versus Goliath, if you will.
Yeah. Looking forward to that one.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, have a good holiday, Sean. And I hope our listeners enjoy the time off as well. We always say we're a proud part of the We Made This podcast network. You heard one of the other great shows a little bit earlier on between the two films. You found out more about the network on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and the website, which is wemadethisnetwork.com. You can also find us on social media, presumably, if you've come to this point of the episode. Number one, you know who we are. And number two, you kind of like us. So if you kind of like us, please do leave us a 5-star review on whatever platform you are listening. It just all helps with the fun word of algorithms. So please do feel free to do that. So when we return on the 28th of September, we will be discussing suing big entities. But until then, I'm Andy Williams.
And I'm Sean Wilson.
And please have a lovely couple of weeks off. Bye-bye.